This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Listen to us on KPFK, KPFA, and other Pacifica affiliates and watch us on Free Speech TV Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. A little covered aspect of the bombshell general election on 11/9 was how labor rights fared. Measures on the so-called right to work passed in Alabama and South Dakota, but failed in Virginia. The Orwellian term right to work obfuscates what many unions say is actually the right to work for less pay. In fact, legislation called right to work undermines union power by allowing employees to work in a closed shop without having to join the union or paying dues. In effect, those workers could take advantage of the benefits of a union job without having to pay for it. Over time, this will ensure unions simply won't have the funds to keep operating. Republicans have successfully introduced bills or initiatives state by state based on model legislation from the corporate-friendly American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, in dozens of states. But where did this idea come from? My guest Cedric De Leon has written a history book about it. He is an associate professor of sociology at Providence College, author of Party and Society, co-editor of Building Blocks. He's a former organizer, local union president, and rank-and-file activist in the U.S. labor movement. He now joins me to discuss his new book. It's called The Origins of Right to Work: Anti-Labor Democracy in 19th Century Chicago. Welcome to the program, Cedric.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. So Chicago in the 19th century is obviously a very sort of fast-changing place. The country is still, the democracy is still sort of forming itself. The kind of ways in which we think about things like employment and work and the role of workers versus the fat cats, those are all issues that are so relevant today, but back then many things were set into play, into motion. Why Chicago? Why does this history of the right to work go back to this one city in the United States?
It goes back to Chicago because this was the city where the biggest battles between labor and capital took place immediately after the Civil War. And the right to work is actually a rhetorical phrase used by politicians in that city to justify violently repressing workers who were organizing their first unions at that time.
Well, why did they use that term itself? Because as I mentioned, of course, it's a very misleading term. Americans, like people all over the world, want to have the right to work. If we just look at it in those terms, many of us don't have the right to work because it's simply too hard to find a job, or our right to work ends up landing us terrible jobs with no pay, no security, low pay, no benefits. The same was obviously true in the 19th century United States, right?
Yes. Well, so that's very interesting, right? Because there is a socialist genealogy of the right to work, which insists that basically all human beings have the right to access employment and to survive. It's kind of a human rights discourse. And then there's the right to work, which is the rhetoric that is used in the United States, as you said in the introduction, to give workers the right to pay or not pay dues to unions. It originated in these battles in Chicago because, as we know, union contracts cover all of the workers in a given workplace, their wages, their working conditions, their hours, benefits, and so forth. And what politicians said was that these contracts, these agreements prevented the individual worker from negotiating a side deal over wages or hours or anything else with an individual employer. And so because of that prohibition, effectively what they argued was that unions enslaved free white men, right? They were preventing the individual wage bargain.
And this, of course, is a very American idea, right? The idea
yes.
of individual personal responsibility and freedom versus collective power.
Yes, that's right. And what's very interesting here is that there is a double standard that is introduced into labor relations at that moment. As soon as they utter this doctrine of right to work, what ends up happening is that they effectively allow employers to combine into institutions like corporations, joint stock companies, and partnerships, right? These people are free individuals or corporate persons. But what the law does at the exact same time is it declares the workers' combination, the labor combination, as a conspiracy, a criminal conspiracy to enslave free white men. And because unions, according to these politicians, enslave free white men, then they were fully within their rights to basically crush them with violent force in the same way that they crushed the Southern Rebellion, which also sought to enslave people.
What role did the traditional parties play in all of this, the political parties? Today, there's clear delineation between the Republicans who are championing the so-called right to work bills and the Democrats who are getting the support of organized labor, but arguably aren't actually earning that support. At least they're giving lip service to union power. Were those dynamics any different in 19th century Chicago?
You know, eerily, they were very similar, because in 19th century Chicago, organized labor, as it was emerging, was struggling with this idea of whether or not they should align with one of the two major parties. And the course that they chose was political independence, that they would essentially endorse candidates, parties, that were pro-labor down the line, regardless, of affiliation.
Wow, what a concept!
What a concept! No, exactly. And I think, you know, what the contrast to the present moment, right, is that organized labor is a captured constituency within the Democratic Party, and by that I mean that they are basically ignored by the political establishment within the Democratic Party. I'm not saying this about the progressive, you know, Bernie Sanders wing, but certainly the centrist political leadership within the Democratic Party largely ignores the demands of labor, though they happily accept the resources from labor. And at the same time, the Republican Party, which doesn't hope to ever court organized labor, essentially feels free to crush labor with these right to work laws, right? And so I think that the two moments are linked, though in sharp contrast to one another, because the 19th century labor movement aspired to move the political party system to their position, whereas contemporary organized labor is essentially being divided, co-opted by the present party system.
And I do want to talk about how workers and union workers might have, you know, voted in the last election. But let's stay on history for a minute longer. I want to focus in on this idea of wage labor, wage dependence. I mean, it's a very interesting idea that I think also links to this aspirational American fantasy that anybody can be free of wage labor if they work hard enough. Why were those terms so popular, this idea of wage labor and wage dependence as a bad thing? I mean, obviously, to have a job that pays you well, which you can do with a union, should be a good thing.
Right. The 19th century had different standards for freedom. And essentially, wage workers were on a par in terms of status with black bonded slaves, right? Because both the wage worker and the slave were subordinate to a master class, right? The industrial employer in the wage workers sense, and the planter in the slave sense. So people frequently called wage workers wage slaves, right?
But I mean, were they really that similar? I mean, to somebody who has enslaved ancestors, those are two extremely different demographics.
Right. No, they are, of course. I mean, I think you'd be hard pressed, to find anybody who thought that, wage work, even in a horrible factory in, Lynn, Massachusetts, experience anything of the sheer horror of being a black bonded slave in Alabama. But still, wage dependency was stigmatized because it wasn't considered economic independence. I mean, the ideal was to be an independent artisan or shopkeeper, right? Or ideally, actually, to be a farmer. So effectively, I mean, in our own terms, you would be your own boss, right? Instead of
working. So the equivalent today is sort of the small business owner, as they put it.
Right. That's exactly right. And so, folks who were wage workers saw that as a kind of temporary staging area for their last big push to finally become, economically independent people.
So then how did unions go about combating these ideas of work as wage slavery and actually, organize unions whose collective power, when it's properly focused, can make huge gains for people? And we know studies after study, even today, shows that union shops generally are, have better wages on average, better benefits on average. It's not perfect, but, compared to non-union shops, this is certainly an advantage to exercising your collective labor.
Yes, no, that's right. I mean, we're talking about kind of historical standards here, but the way that unions tried to carve out something resembling a life of economic independence, given the standards of the 19th century, was to organize for the 8-hour day. Right. Prior to the advent of the 8-hour day, workers worked 10, 12, in some cases 14 hours a day in a sweatshop or a factory, went home, went to sleep, woke up and did the same exact thing the next day. They did not feel like they were in charge of their lives. They never got to see their loved ones. They never got to hang out with their friends, have a beer on a Sunday or any of that stuff. And so what they tried to do was then divide the workday up into three separate, sections, right? 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what you will, right? And, so this is the struggle for the 8-hour day, which the American working class eventually won, right? Brought us the weekend. This is, there are all these bumper stickers, right? I'm sure out in California, saying, the labor movement, the folks who brought you the weekend, and that's true, right? I mean, so this is how they tried to live a life of economic independence under conditions of industrial servitude. It was to compress the workday into a small amount of the day as possible so that they could live their lives in the other part of the day.
Now, we're still in the historic context talking about white male workers, right?
Yes.
So how did this intersect with the abolition movement, if at all, in Chicago, and the women's movement?
Yes. The labor movement and the civil rights movement were, in fact, united within the radical Republican coalition after the Civil War. That's the faction of the Republican Party that was overtly abolitionist, right? There were other factions of the party that did not really care about the emancipation of slaves. But the radicals who were basically in charge in the early years after the Civil War basically commanded the loyalty of both the abolitionist / civil rights movement and the labor movement. And in fact, the labor movement initially after the Civil War was a biracial labor movement, right? But what ended up happening over time, and in fact very quickly, by 1867, black workers, black union members were forced out of national labor federations like the National Labor Union to found their own union, which was called the Colored or Negro National Labor Union. And this was not as much because of the leadership, though they bear some responsibility, but I would say in large part because of social segregation from below in the actual lived experience of people, of workers on the ground. And you know, white workers just did not want to mix with black workers, despite the exertions of many of their idealistic labor leaders.
What about women workers? Today, of course, women are an integral part of the workforce, particularly when we're talking about rank and file. Of course, in corporate boardrooms, it's a whole different story, but rank and file workers, women are a very, very large force. So how does history, did that history come up in 19th century Chicago?
It did not come up in 19th century Chicago in the period that I studied. The women's movement really, I mean, many of the folks who would be the precursors of you know, the first wave feminism in the United States were involved, you know, in social reform movements such as the abolitionist movement and the temperance movement in the period that I am studying. The women's movement really takes off, you know, in the late 1880s and early 1890s. And there, again, what you have is a situation where the women's movement is largely apart from the labor movement. The labor movement is enfranchised and, you know, very much a part of the mainstream two-party machinery, right? Whereas women, of course, as we know, were disfranchised and so had to figure out different ways of organizing and getting the attention of political elites. And as a matter of fact, it was women. It was the feminist movement, right? The women's movement who basically invented what we now today call lobbying. Okay, that is, you know, lobbying from the left, right? So they would basically go into state capitals and hang out in the lobby and accost elites and do all sorts of other innovative kind of organizing techniques in order to get their attention, right? So, but again, you know, not really with the help of labor at all. You know, the history of labor, civil rights, and women's movement in this country is really a history of fracture, which is really unfortunate, because if these, you know, if these constituents could actually join forces in a coherent and sustained way, I mean, it could be a sight to see.
Now, in your book, you talk about the German community in Chicago, in 19th century Chicago, as a case study for the story of how the labor movement evolved. Tell us that story. What role did the German community play, and what examples can we draw from within that community to understand this bigger issue?
The main role that German workers play is to basically defect from the Democratic Party. Okay, prior to the Civil War, the Democratic Party had been, you know, what social scientists call the hegemonic party, right? In America, their hold on power, particularly in places like Chicago, was complete. Okay, and this was largely because they had the allegiance of the two largest immigrant working class constituencies in the United States, the Irish and the Germans. And we also know that the Democrats, you know, later on become the party of the South and of segregation and so forth. The role of German workers is essentially to break the power of the Democratic Party, okay, and elevate the Republican Party, which at that time was just an upstart third party, right, and put slavery on the table as a contestable political issue, really, in the middle of the 19th century, right? I mean, so that's, I would say that is their major role in American history, is to break the power of the Democratic Party so that we could move on to other issues, such as the emancipation of slave labor and also the status of free labor in the labor movement after the Civil War.
Okay, so let's move to the present. There are 20-something states today that have a so-called right to work law, it's as part of their the law of the land. How do you trace the line between these battles, political battles in 19th century Chicago, to what's happening today? Did the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, this once secret conglomeration of corporate and political elites, reach back into history and say, aha, here is an idea that needs revival?
Well, I think, so, you know, right to work has been a pole in this debate over worker rights since the 19th century, and right to work has reemerged over and over again throughout history. And I think it's important to understand that right to work typically reemerges at an inflection point in the life cycle of the labor movement. So it emerges, you know, at the beginning of the labor, of the modern labor movement as we know it, in the 1860s, to basically snuff it out before it gains traction. It reemerges in the 1920s, in the so-called progressive, right, open shop movement, in order to check the rise of socialism. And the socialists and communists were infiltrating the labor movement at that time. It emerges yet again in the late 1940s and early 50s, when organized labor was at the height of its influence, right? So essentially to undercut the power of labor in its ascendancy. And I think it is with us now at another inflection point in the life cycle of the labor movement, which is a moment of union decline, right? I mean, I think that, you know, there are politicians and employers who are counting on this moment to basically rid the United States of the last remnants of workers' collective power forever. So I think that is a really important lineage right there. We can talk about other things, such as the fact that, for example, right to work is often brought up not by employers, but actually by politicians, right? We often think about industrial conflict and unions and so forth being between workers and bosses. And what I've tried to do in this book and in my career is to show that, you know, politicians are really playing an important role in these industrial conflicts. And I don't think it's any accident that ALEC, whom you mentioned, is really involved, and that Republican Party elites are really central to pushing this as a legislative agenda item.
And this all goes back to the central ideology that powerful elites like to promote, that personal responsibility is something that's much more important, personal freedoms, personal choices, much more important than people to band together and exercise collective power. You know, the 99% versus the 1% is what they fear. And so to break that, to promote, you know, it's important to promote this idea that individuals can be the ones, as long as you work hard with promoting the myth of the meritocracy, as long as you work hard and you're innovative and talented, you rise to the top. But we know time and again, of course, that this doesn't really play out. It might play out on the small scale. There are exceptions to the rule. But is this why so many workers, you know, that through the analysis of people like Thomas Frank, vote against their own interests, right? Like Americans, white working class Americans, and many other white Americans, this election round picked a billionaire to represent them as the person that they see as providing the answer to income inequality, as if this person at the very top is even interested in helping the people at the very bottom.
Right. Well, I think that this goes back to an earlier question you asked, which is about, you know, the relationship between political parties and workers, right? Because I think that Trump's victory has a great deal to do with the fact that organized labor has been a captured constituency within the Democratic Party, like black people, and increasingly Latinos and Asians, right? And by captured constituency, what I mean is that they're ignored by the Democratic Party and unhoped for by the Republican Party. The Democrats ignore the labor movement and the concerns of black people, for example, because they know that, you know, that organized labor and the African-American community have basically nowhere else to go, right? The other side is basically not an alternative. And at the same time, the Republicans, knowing that they're a captured constituency in the Democratic Party, will not try to court their vote. And I mean here the political establishment of the Republican Party. And what you have in Trump, right, is this call to the white working class in particular. I mean, he said it many times during the campaign, right? The white working class has been a forgotten people in this country, and they will not be forgotten anymore. You don't have a voice, I am your voice. And so to a captured constituency who's basically unhoped for by one party and then ignored by another party, I think that there's a constituency there that did, I think, rightfully feel ignored. Whether Trump and his white nativist rhetoric or policy agenda, to the degree that there is an agenda, you know, will actually help them, which I don't think it will, is a different question altogether. But I think that he was speaking there to a yearning, right, to a vacuum in public policy that has basically ignored the concerns of working people in the labor movement for at least a generation, if not more.
Right, and all the only other major party option that people had was Hillary Clinton, who had to be dragged kicking and screaming by a figure like Bernie Sanders to take even, you know, a handful of left positions, and certainly on things like free trade agreements, Trump had her beat in terms of taking a position in favor of working class voters of any race. So yes, I think this is a really interesting position here. Now, there was an interesting report after the election as people tried to make sense of who voted, how people voted, who didn't vote. And one report I saw found that organized labor, which of course does a lot of get out the vote work right before elections, did their work, but it's not clear if a significant number of them, actually the people that came out and voted, ended up in Trump's camp. And there's some sense that a lot of union households defied their leaders and voted for Trump. What do you know about the union vote this election?
You know, I think it is still a little bit too early to tell exactly what the union vote did. But I can tell you anecdotally from my friends in the Michigan labor movement. I was a local union president in the Michigan labor movement for a few years in another life. That a lot of UAW, that is United Auto Worker households, white UAW households, particularly in the northern suburbs of Detroit, though they gave their votes to President Obama in the last two elections, basically defected from Hillary Clinton and gave their ballots to Mr. Trump. I think it's a little bit too early to tell, just exactly to what degree. I mean, is this a kind of Reagan Democrat moment? I'm not sure. There's certainly some defection that happened, but I'm just, you know, I would be hesitant to make any huge claims at this moment,
right,
about the union vote and Trump.
We do know that about 100 million eligible voters did not even cast a ballot in this election. So let me ask you this then. What about the issue of the momentum around these right to work bills that have now, you know, become law in at least half the country? I mentioned a couple of states, Alabama and South Dakota, where they passed, one state where they failed, in Wisconsin in 2011, major battle around the right to work. How do you assess the momentum and the successes of ALEC and the Republican Party's push to have these bills become law around the country?
I think they've been hugely successful, and I think that they showed some chutzpah in beginning the most recent right to work wave in the industrial heartland of the country. I mean, to go after Indiana and Michigan and Ohio and Wisconsin as Trump, you know, did in this election, I think was very brash. And I think that it caught the labor movement unawares. I think that they've been hugely successful now for the first time since, you know, since the category of right to work state was invented. A majority of states, 26 out of 50 states, are right to work. And, you know, the last additions were the ones that I just mentioned, and also West Virginia. I will say, however, that ALEC and the Right to Work Coalition and the far right wing of the Republican Party have failed in a number of states too, and we don't hear a lot about that. Actually, they failed in Ohio in 2011 in a hugely contested referendum. They failed in Missouri, Kentucky, and also Maine. And what's interesting about those cases is that they failed largely because of bipartisan opposition to right to work. Whereas, for example, in places like Indiana and Wisconsin, the 99% of the legislative opposition to the right to work came to the Democratic Party, came from the Democratic Party, which meant that, you know, Republicans were not on board. Republicans from working class districts with lots of union members had not been pushed by the labor movement to support organized labor in those fights. So I would say that ALEC and their allies have been largely very successful, but I think that they have failed in certain ways that that the labor movement and all progressives should pay attention to, because they are vulnerable. They can be beaten. It would be one thing if we beat them once, but we've beaten them four times in the last 4 years, and I think we should take heart.
Well, does history bode or allow you to make any predictions about the way in which this particular inflection point, as you called it, in labor's evolution will head? I mean, labor is in decline. Will we mm-hmm. see a resurgence of unionism, presumably if union leaders and, you know, all of the rest of us start to do the right things for those who see unions as a positive force and union labor, unionized labor as a positive force to combat corporatism and this new gilded age we're living in?
Right. Well, I think that the labor movement has been down and out at many points in U.S. history and has faced employers and anti-labor politicians just as scary, if not scarier, in the past. I mean, in the past, the state and capital had no compunction whatsoever about assassinating labor, right, and killing workers on picket lines, right? So we're not there anymore, right? And so what I'm suggesting is that organized labor has faced, you know, harsher foes in the past, foes better than Donald. I mean, more ruthless. And so I'm always hopeful about the ability of the labor movement to rise up from the ashes, as it has done many, many times in the past. But it does actually require, you know, a coherent agenda and strategy, right? I think that on the local level, local and state level, the labor movement needs to be ready for future right to work battles by organizing bipartisan opposition, particularly peeling off Republicans representing working class districts in their states. And I think that also the labor movement should now work on trying to repeal right to work in the states where it already exists, right? And I think that this is actually, I think, a vulnerable moment for the Trump regime, because he talks a big game about representing the white working class.
He's promised them a lot of things.
Yes, and I think if the white working class tells him to put his money where his mouth is, right, and oppose right to work, and they watch him and his allies say, well, I don't know if I can oppose right to work, I think it's a good thing, then I think, you know, these white sectors of the white working class will say, oh, okay, I actually thought you were my voice, and really you were just bamboozling us into our coalition. Then I think you have the makings of a defection from the Trump coalition, right? And I think that the Democratic Party and progressive movement should be working on basically causing a mass defection, right, among open-minded progressive, you know, folks within the Trump coalition to move out and back to the light. But I also think that organized labor needs to advance a coherent agenda for a more just society. I mean, you know, this is the sad thing, and I'm a trade unionist, right? I've been for most of my adult life, right, a union person. So I think I've won the right to say this. I don't know what the labor movement is for anymore. What is our agenda for a more just society? And I think that we need to seriously show the American public that we are fighting for everybody and not just our own members. And the moment that we settle on that and execute it and organize, you know, and when people see us do that, I think that we can begin to turn, you know, the anti-labor climate that we are seeing right now around.
Right. And there are some, of course, really great unions that do take such things to heart. I'm thinking of National Nurses United, et cetera. Well, yes. Cedric, we're out of time. A lengthy conversation on a very important topic. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Sonali.
Cedric De Leon is an associate professor of sociology at Providence College, author of Party and Society, co-editor of Building Blocks. He's a former organizer, former local union president, and rank-and-file activist in the U.S. labor movement, speaking to me about his new book called The Origins of Right to Work, Anti-Labor Democracy in 19th Century Chicago. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/ Are You with Sonali?